Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings. I am Brian Nemhauser. You can find me and all that we do at Hawk Blogger on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, pretty much everywhere. And every Friday is a Blue Friday during the season with our good pal, Mike Sando. How are you doing on this very wet week in the Northwest?
You know, we're dry, and the people that in our little realm, our little world, you know, have so far dodged, having to evacuate or anything like that, even though one of our sons does live, in an area that has been affected, but just not right up to them. So we're grateful for that and hope others are, had the news is good for them, too.
Yeah. We're always sending our best out to everyone that's going through it. And it is biblical, as it said, I think today in the Seattle Times. It is a little bit funny is the wrong word, but I don't know how national news covers these things because I don't watch news at this point. But the amount of people calling to check in, like, are you guys okay? Like, make it sound like the entire state is underwater right now, which is very nice that people are calling. Yeah. But I wish the reporting was a little more accurate.
Yeah, well, it's just specific. It's kind of like, this, Brian, people, if I'm in, if I'm in Louisiana and somebody asks where I'm from, I say I'm from Seattle.
Right.
You know, if I'm in Seattle and someone asks where I'm from, I would say, near Tacoma or whatever. You know what I mean? But then if I was in Tacoma and somebody asked where I was at, I would say specifically where I'm from, which is not, it may not be exactly in Tacoma, but near it. So I think there's just a generality there. And people just don't have a feel for other areas and what, they don't know. We couldn't tell specifically all the areas of Houston or whatever, right? So that's what it is.
Well, it's nice that we've gotten a little bit of a reprieve from the rain. It was supposed to rain the entire week. And so hopefully things are going to calm down a bit, although I think we're going to get a little bit more rain. And we'll see if that affects this game Sunday. As of now, I think the prediction is that the rain will not be happening during the game, which is this weird anomaly where, for whatever reason, it doesn't rain during games at Lumen for the most part. But I wanted to thank you. Before we get into all this other stuff, for folks that don't know, I published an article yesterday that I've been working on for a while on John Schneider and the work that he has done to kind of transition from Pete Carroll. And whenever I have a big project, I always ask Mike and Dave Bowling for a little help and an extra eye before I publish it. And Mike was very kind to read what was a very long piece and give me a lot of feedback so I could make some adjustments that absolutely helped tighten it up. So really, really thank you for taking
a word here, a word there. But sometimes those little one words are, that's what we're looking for, so it's always, I like to do the same thing. In fact, Dave Bowling's been great for me. Sometimes I'd run, send something that we're just about to publish it, and he would just, other people can see, something that we can't see when we write it, just a little thing here or there. And sometimes those were the things you regret 3 days later after it published and no one else even really noticed. But in your mind, it was like, oh, that word is not what I meant. It's not exact. So I'm glad to make it 1% better, but it was a really good piece already. And it's great.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I was curious, not everyone will be interested in this, but it's my show. So I'm curious in it. And I'm going to ask, what's your process? I know there aren't that many really big pieces anymore. They don't just go as deep. And to be honest, I talked to folks at The Athletic, as you know, and I talked to folks at The Ringer and talked to some places where this could have lived, but it just, there's not really a home for this kind of stuff anymore. That's a separate conversation. I'm curious, when you have this much stuff, like I talked to so many people, I had so many notes and so many quotes. How do you go about kind of corralling that yourself? What's your process for then turning it into a succinct story?
Definitely. There's a great saying, perfection is not achieved when there's nothing left to add. Perfection is achieved when there's nothing left to take away. So it's a hard thing to do to yourself to try to reduce things down. I think I have a pretty good governor for that. But I'll give you an example. Like I did a piece 5-6 years ago that I really got into and it was really fun. It was about this old feud in the NFL between Sam Weiss, who was the Bengals coach, and Jerry Glanville, who was a very colorful coach of the Houston Oilers. And they went back and forth in the media. And at one point, Sam Weiss ran up the score 61-7 on him and kicked a field goal with like 10 seconds left. The players were like, what are we doing? You know? And it was just such a great feud. And these guys had great quotes, and I talked to players, and I did this piece and I really liked it, but it was like 50% too long. You know, I didn't cut it back. And for whatever reason, our process at the time, you know, probably at The Athletic, we were probably a little bit, you know, we're probably better edited now, you know? And mm-hmm. so it ran, and I like it, but it's just too long. It just goes on forever. So after a while, you know, of doing this stuff a lot, you should get a good feel. But I do think having editors that have that scrutinize really helps. And getting that honest feedback from somebody who, you know, that's their job. So I think that really, really, really helps. And some of we do a lot of big pieces. You know, I did a big one last year on the coaching trends, you know, and I spent a year on it, you know, really on and off for a year, and talked to tons of people. And by the time it ran, you know, we had debates about things, whether this is going to work or that. And then even in the end, we were going to publish this thing, and we happened to be in Indianapolis at the combine. And so our whole team was there, including people that do the visuals. And I mean, we ended up pushing the thing back like 2 days because myself, editor, and the head of our visuals department, we were almost debating. We were like sitting at a bar during the day, not drinking alcohol, don't worry. But we were debating about how to do this. And she was, the person in charge of visuals was adamant that certain things just didn't work the way we had it. And so it was very educational for me because I'm a writer, but I'm not an expert on the visuals part of it. And we went back and forth. Shoot, we made that thing 50% better in 24 hours with some really hard conversations and some things at the cutting room floor.
Wow.
So I love that whole process. And I think I'm in a position now where I'm at with the people that I work with, where we get that. But when if you're not, or you're doing, you know, you're a one man band, you can still do the great work, but it does help to have somebody say, this is too long, or, you know, and most people won't say that. Like, I would say that to you because we know each other well enough. Like, I'm just going to be honest, you know, and I was honest with you, and you didn't, I didn't say it was too long or anything. It was a word here or there. So the more that you can get that in your process with the right people, it's great. If you have the wrong people who just have opinions and want to throw their weight around and they feel like, hey, I haven't done my job unless I really change your story, that's frustrating as a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I've talked to a lot of writers that experience that. But where do you start?
I don't have that, though. I don't really have that.
Where do you start? You said you worked on a piece for a year. So when you have all this information,
like, I'm turning something off here.
Yeah, sure. He's got it's probably his ice machine.
It's my freaking ice maker kicks on. Yeah. You can't even hear it, but it drives me crazy. But I like it. So what were your question?
So when you're done with all the research and you're ready to sit down to write, what's your process? Where do you start? Do you write a headline first? Do you like outline it? For me, I literally, I'll write a headline and that's kind of my center. And then I just sit down and I start writing. But what's your process?
So it used to be the hardest part. And sometimes you would spend a whole, but you get so much enjoying the research and learning that by the time you get done with that, you don't even want to write it. It's kind of like somebody, you ever talk to someone who's a great cook and they work all day to prepare this meal for 10 people and they don't even want to eat it by the end of it. You know, even though it's a great meal, they're just like, you know, I'm good. and so sometimes that can happen, but I'll give you a real secret here that's really helped me, and I just stumbled into it. A lot of what I do, like when I'm researching and I'm going around the teams, or I'm doing a Zooms with people in the league, you've got to be able to present efficiently. So what I do is, a lot of times, because I do this anyway to show people, if I can get it into a succinct PowerPoint type thing, and now I'm going to show this to this, I have to show this to somebody who's never seen it before, and this person's time is really valuable. And you better nail this thing, and it's gotta be quick. So you have to be able to boil it down, you know, without having 50 PowerPoint slides that are all covered with a bunch of stuff. No. We gotta be able to do this in a few minutes. And because you're gonna lose people right away. So if you can present it quickly and succinctly, you've got your starting point. Then you almost have your sections right there, right? You've got it down to three bullet points or whatever.
Yeah.
You could do the if you were to present the Schneider story, you would not just go into someone and read it to them, right?
Right.
But you could probably, if I said to you, I want this on three slides, and you have 6 minutes to present it, you should be able to do that.
Yeah. I love
that. If you
can
do that, you've got your start. What's the starting point?
That's a great prompt, because you're absolutely right. I used to be a big procrastinator growing up. Like, I was the guy that was always late with my homework and, you know, took every minute I could. Yeah. And then I just realized it's a way more stressful way to live. So I get everything done. So then I have like nothing but free time in front of me. But when you've got this amount of research and figuring out how to, one, start the story, and then two, honor the story without like overwhelming people with like all the things you heard, that first moment's really tough. So I love that prompt. And I'm curious, where do you think, what's your take on John Schneider in general, and what's your take on the work that he's done since the Pete Carroll transition, and where do you think he kind of falls in the executive of the year conversation?
Well, he's got to be at the top. You know, I think for we in the past, you sort of had to read between the lines or have some inside sources to know that, okay, the team is acting as a team, and you know, Pete and John, Pete Carroll, John Schneider, generally unified on certain things. But you know, we figured out over time, and Pete Carroll even gave John Schneider credit for drafting Russell Wilson. But you could kind of see, okay, this guy would probably be a Pete guy. I think what you're just seeing now is, okay, we have all that knowledge of how it went. We sort of thought these things about John Schneider. And now we've seen him with a different coach and with more, more control from the start than he had before. And I think you can kind of see a little bit more what, a clearer picture of him probably comes into to focus here. And I think it's positive for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, and I've known John Schneider since he got to Seattle in 2010, but not like overly closely. You know, I mean, I know him, but I know more people who know him around the league, and he's really well regarded within the league. I know that. And I think that this has been a very validating, probably, couple of seasons, for him in a different light with a little bit of a stronger role.
Yeah. And one of there's a lot of different kind of tightrope walks I was doing when I was writing this. And one of them was, this wasn't a hit job on Pete Carroll. Like that wasn't the intent. And no. I don't think John would want that to be the intent, to be honest. It's not like he feels like this is a revenge tour he's on.
No.
But there is this distinction between how those two lead. As much as they're friends, they're very different people, and they show up in a very different way. And I think one of the things that, I mean, I don't think executive of the year or maybe even people across the league care about whether a GM is a culture creator. Like, I think they more care about coaches being culture creators. But I thought that was one of the most interesting things I kind of found and learned in this, is how much he's invested in the entire organization being people that are humble, people that are good people, people that he, like, whether they're a trainer or a front, you know, person working at the front desk, receptionist, whoever, he's just very intent on everybody feeling that they're part of the organization and no one's above somebody else, which I think says a lot about where this team is too.
Well, you know what I thought was really interesting about it? And I told you that I thought the best section was on the culture stuff. And what's really, to me, cool about it and says a lot about John Schneider is, this was sort of in collaboration with Dr. Michael Gervais, right?
Right.
Well, that's a Pete Carroll guy.
Mm-hmm.
And John Schneider, that shows that John Schneider is about what he thinks. He learned a lot of great stuff from Pete. You know, he's probably way better at what he does and just better in life from being around Pete, because anybody would be. Not only a master coach, but he's somebody who's really thought about how he goes about things, you know, very intentional. And I think that if John Schneider just wanted to turn the page and make this the John Schneider show, he could have pushed all the Pete stuff out of there, right? But that thing about the going on the walks and stuff,
mm-hmm.
that's coming from Pete Carroll's guy.
Yeah.
And John Schneider's seeing that and saying, man, there's a lot of really great stuff that Pete Carroll did. I'm sure it was hard to fire him, you know?
Yeah. Well,
but it was the right thing for the organization at this time to move on.
It and was.
He saw that, you know?
Sorry to interrupt, Mike.
Go ahead. I'm going to need a drink anyway.
So, yeah, I'm kind of curious, looking back on that now, I mean, I definitely was of the mind it had been time for a little while. It was time. And it seems like as far as a respectful way to end, as probably as close to doing it as you could. But there were a lot of people that just felt like Pete was very wronged, were very frustrated with that. Do you think that the way they exited with Pete was maybe the optimal way compared to maybe having what happened in like Vegas happen here and having him kind of get kicked out in a different way?
I think it's very hard. You know, like, what's the best way to get divorced, right? It's just mm-hmm. still a divorce, you know?
Right.
But I think this was, if you were to compare this to a divorce where there wasn't a bunch of fighting and there wasn't violence, or you know what I mean? There wasn't hatred, right? It was just to a point. I think this happens sometimes with teams, you know, where it was probably time to move on. And I think the ultimate test of that was that Pete Carroll wasn't willing to make some of the changes that, that it was agreed upon needed to be made. And yeah. So once that happens, then you're at a sticking point. I almost kind of respect Pete for, he had a line and he wasn't just going to, he had his opinion and he was willing to walk away from it.
You know, it's funny you use the word respect there. I don't think my respect for Pete changed at all at any point. Like I think what changed for me was just that I think he wandered from his principles in terms of always compete and really getting the best players on the field.
Accountability
in general, his coaching staff. Like there were some things that I noticed early on that he got away with. Like he never really hired good assistant coaches for the most part, or like people that went on to become head coaches. That ended up catching up to him. And a lot of things, just his style of how he played, you know, wanted to play defense. He kind of got passed by in that. So it was time, but I never lost any respect for him. I worry that people will have with the way things have gone this year.
Yeah. But I don't think that, I mean, this doesn't, that's a whole separate thing to me. I'm sure that this thing with the Raiders, unless he turns it around, is going to, you know, put a mark on his legacy that he'd rather not have. But I think if mm-hmm. you, and that may affect people's opinions for Hall of Fame or all this type of stuff. But I think he's still one of the great coaching success stories in football history, not just NFL, you know, across NFL and college football with a 50-year career. And if you were to look at the number of seasons that were successful and the successful stories of the people and the players, it's awesome. So I think the further we get away from, you know, the moment of Seattle being good and the Raiders being bad, the easier that will be to see.
Well, and you know, people are like Pete Carroll's legacy. It's not like, I mean, Bill Belichick, his year is not going that much better than Pete's. It just happens to be at a lower level of football and also including off-field shenanigans. So if Bill Belichick, do you think Bill Belichick will be back in the NFL, by the way?
I don't think so as a coach. I think just from an age standpoint. And also, I just don't think there's teams lining up to hire him at this stage and give him all that power.
Yeah.
I think the sideshow thing with his, you know, there's a lot of noise around him and the girlfriend thing. I don't know who's signing up for that.
Yeah. That's it is really interesting just to see that fall from grace. I don't know if grace is the right phrase for where Bill's ever been in his career, but you know, it's two of the legendary coaches and they're not going out on their terms, which is actually a decent segue to talk about another legend who's decided to re-enter the sphere, Philip Rivers at 44 years old. he's, you know, he could, you know, he would have been like a younger brother for me, man. He was just around the corner from where I was age. So he's now looking like he's going to step on the field Sunday. And I'm dying to know, what was your reaction when you heard the news?
I mean, I get it. It shows how desperate they are. I think that what it is for, I'm almost surprised they would play him this week, because I think it should be as much as anything for the Colts, just a psychological boost until he plays and it has a really horrible game. I just think their team is really hurting right now. They had this great season going. It was starting to fall off even before Daniel Jones got hurt. Part of me thinks that really the injury spares them from missing the playoffs with Daniel Jones there, or
that would have been
being one and done.
Yep.
And so now they're spared from that. But their team is feeling as though their chances went out the window with Daniel Jones. So I think it's kind of like, you know, when I used to do the podcast with Randy Mueller, you know, a longtime Seahawk executive now at the Saints. We used to do a podcast at The Athletic. He used to always say, like, remember when the Seahawks signed Franco Harris? It was like, mm-hmm. We knew Franco was done, you know, basically. But it was like our team at that time just needed some sort of someone to walk in that door that showed that we were still going to go down swinging, you know. I think Philip Rivers is the Franco Harris of the Colts. And I have huge questions about his ability to even make it through a whole game on this short of notice.
Yeah.
If you go back to, there's a similar situation with a little bit of a lesser quarterback, and that was Steve DeBerg had been out for the 94, 5, 6, 7 seasons. And then he came back with the Falcons in 1998, and it was on their team in camp at age 44. And he had to start a game in week 8 against the Jets, and they lost 28-3. That Falcons team was 14-2. So the one game he started, they lost 28-3. There's plays where he's backing out from under center and staggered and fell. I mean, he got you know, they housed a fumble on him. He got like hit in the mouth with a blitz that he would have normally seen and didn't see. And so, look, I Philip Rivers is probably gonna be, he may be better than that, but I just think it's going to be so hard. Just look at the mugshots of 44-year-old Tom Brady versus 44-year-old Philip Rivers in their face, and just how, you know, I mean, Rivers looks like he's in good shape for a 44-year-old former athlete.
Yeah.
Brady looked like he slept in the hyperbaric chamber for the last 10 years, because he did.
Right.
And to me, it's too much to ask to go out there. Now, he's going to be in the shotgun, and I'm sure he's going to get the ball out quick, but there's going to be times when he has to hold it and try to make something happen. And I think he's going to have a hard time.
Yeah. It'll be, if he manages to play passable football, I mean, let's take good off the table, but like he maybe plays well, but if he plays passably, then in one hand, it kind of will say something about what's required to be a decent NFL quarterback. Like an average starter, because if he can come in after this break with, there's no way he's been training the way an NFL player or professional athlete trains. And if he's able to do that, then I think it, like, what would that say about all of the young players that are trying to break into this league that can't cut it in their prime, you know, like some ways it would really paint this picture of how much better the quarterbacks were in terms of processing IQ, in terms of all the things compared to some of the guys now, where maybe it's not quite the same. I don't know.
Well, it's a great conversation. There's been a big debate on this. In fact, you've probably followed some of it online, you know, with Kevin O'Connell of the Vikings kind of talking about pure progression, passing. Pure
progression. This is a big conversation right now. Big conversation.
Kurt Warner's weighing in. Yeah. Brian Hoyer's weighing in. It's awesome.
You put part of that thread from like coaches. Where was that from?
The what from coaches?
You put up like a thread from coaches talking about the.
Well, that was in my story. That was in that big story I spent the year on last year about trends in coaching towards youth in the game, and some of the fallout with younger coaches and younger quarterbacks and less time to practice is that the league has gone away from having a fully fledged offensive system with answers for everything, right? Think of Brady or Manning or Rivers at the line of scrimmage deciphering, right? And really going next level to figure out everything the defense is doing. And there's this big sort of conversation and debate in the league right now, because a lot of people that are in the league now say, even including John Harbaugh, who's an old school guy, told me, I hate it when reporters say told me. I hate that. Just say said. But he did say, he said it in the story, that Peyton Manning would have a hard time playing the way he played the game in today because defensive disguise is so good. The idea before was get to the line of scrimmage, wait a long enough time, move some people around, or in Peyton's case, they would just stay static in Indianapolis, and he would get an absolute clear, detailed picture of the defense, and then he would be in the exact right play for that. And what they're saying now is in the league, you can't do that because of all these late rotations, and the defenses are so much better at disguising that instead of having an answer for everything the way Rivers would, you just need to bail and get onto a different play. Get out of here, get in, do something else, have a couple plays. And so there's a big divide kind of in coaching over whether that is dumbing it down. To what degree that is that dumbing it down for a young player who maybe it helps him succeed a little bit now, but he never reaches a ceiling, right? So there's all these things going on like that in the league where Ben Johnson kind of wants Caleb Williams to have to learn how to play pro quarterback. So he's not doing a bunch of RPOs and easy stuff. But it also like, hey, Caleb Williams is a great running around guy too. So where's the, you know, how do you make him grow into it? There's all this stuff going on. So I forgot where we even started on this.
That's the fast, you took in the right direction because
Rivers.
Whatever happens with him Sunday and the rest of this season, depending on how far he makes it, is going to be a commentary on the state of quarterback in the NFL. There's no way it won't be. And some people will just say, oh, Philip Rivers, he's a legend, he's a Hall of Famer, all that stuff, which is true, and only he can. But I'll say this, if I was in Indianapolis and I was a supporter of that team, I would feel a lot better of their chances with this guy taking the snaps than Riley Leonard.
Well, here's my question for you. Would you rather have a healthy 44-year-old Rivers just coming out of retirement, or would you rather have a healthy Anthony Richardson if those were your choices? To go down the stretch,
I think you're more likely to win with Philip Rivers.
Isn't that amazing?
If Anthony Richardson was healthy, I don't think Philip Rivers would be here.
I agree. But so think of this: if the Colts were bringing back Matt Ryan, would people be more or less excited? Even though Ryan played way more recently.
Yeah,
I think this is like Tyson coming back, where people are like, oh, geez, it's Tyson. Look at him hit the bag.
That's a good one. That is a good one, Mike.
Look at those combinations of Tyson, man. This is a bad man. He looks just like when he fought.
Did you watch the Tyson-Jake Paul fight?
I got it, and I watched boxing religiously from 80s through 90s, and then I haven't really watched since then. You know, life intervened, got married, all that stuff. But I paid-per-viewed that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was laughable.
It was so hard to watch, and – you know, obviously, I think a quiet challenge for the Seahawks in this game, and they're almost 14-point favorites in some places in this game, is I just don't believe it's hard for any competitor to be so focused on their own performance and not at all let it leak in who's playing on the other side. And when you've got a 44-year-old guy who's been out of the league for 5 years, they're all saying the right things, but they also think it's kind of funny. And if he starts completing passes against them, or they don't take him seriously, or there's all no, it could be a more like psychologically challenging game for Seattle than I think some are expecting it to be.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's only upside for the Colts and only downside for the Seahawks, right?
Right. I mean,
to me, if Rivers goes out and has a horrible game and gets replaced in the second half, I don't think it says anything.
Right.
I mean, that's just kind of what should happen. And hey, he tried, and you know, maybe you can get him next week.
Yeah.
But if he comes out and goes, you know, 11 for 14 for 108 yards and a touchdown in the first half, you're going to be like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Mike, do you have to run here at half past? You got a few more minutes?
I got a few more minutes. Yeah.
All right. So I wanted to talk to you as well about this game from last night, the Thursday night game, the Bucs-Falcons game.
Yeah.
Which you got to love this in the NFL when a team can look as completely hapless as the Falcons did against the Seahawks. And I don't think that's just the Falcons. I think the Seahawks had something to do that. And then go down to Tampa Bay in a game where they were already eliminated for the playoffs, and Tampa Bay is fighting for a division title in their home field, and the Falcons beat them. They beat them, and my goodness, I assume you've heard Todd Bowles post-game.
Oh, outstanding.
What's your take on what we saw last night?
Here's the thing that was so great about Todd Bowles is, you know, he said the F word like seven times or something, but he said it with usually when that happens, it's Dennis Green or it's Jerry Burns. It's one of these guys just loses it, you know, usually to do F-bombs. This was like a slow and deliberate, like he wasn't losing it. I would hate to see Todd Bowles when he loses it because he was like measured.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing scary about his tone, but man, he had to be mad.
Yeah.
The Falcons had 19 penalties and won the game.
Unbelievable.
125 yards, 19 penalties, 125 yards, and won the game.
That is unbelievable. I think they had 9 penalties in the first half, and it was like this, oh, yeah, we got to stop our penalties anymore. So I was like, well, how about you hold my beer, and we get 10 in the second half?
I mean, the penalty margin, it was 19-4, so 50, they were 15 more penalties than your opponent and you won the game. I think it's appalling for Tampa Bay. And the other thing that Bowles said was he started talking, he put it on players, which I guess he did a few years ago when Brady was there too. And they had a little lull and they finished strong, but he was just like, hey, there's nothing, the coaches can't do anything more. This is we got a small group of players here and need to be more accountable. And that's got to happen. From within.
I got to say Tampa Bay has got to be one of the most, polarizing teams in terms of people's perception coming into the season. People are like, hey, this is a Super Bowl contending team. They started off really strong. I admit I started my preseason. I was like, Mike, I think the Bucks are overrated. Then I saw the first 5 games. I was like, I think the Bucks are better than I thought. And now I'm like, hey, maybe I was right the first time. Like Baker Mayfield was this guy who was MVP. And everyone's like, now would you take Baker Mayfield or would you take Sam Darnold? Like,
Yeah, I think that Baker's been hurt, and I think that that seems evident to me. Obviously, he was hurt for a while, but I just don't think he looks. I think he was struggling out there, and some of that the footing looked bad too. He just did not look. He was off, and even to win the game late, he was behind the guy. Remember the pass got broken up.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a pretty accurate passer, so I think they are diminished right now.
He was taking sacks. I saw him, his head was dropping to the ground. He wasn't looking up when the pressure was coming. He was just kind of, I don't know. And then he throws a key interception. It just, it looks like the Carolina Panthers might end up being the team at this point for the Bucks to win that division. They have to win both games against the Panthers.
I wouldn't put anything past anyone there. I don't think the Panthers are that great either. I think if the Bucs won last night, they win the division.
Yeah.
So now, you know, all bets are off, but I still think that I think they're going to at least split with them. But, you know, Carolina got New Orleans this week. Carolina already lost to New Orleans once.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows?
Now excited about Tyler Shuck. We got Tyron Matthew and all these guys talking about him like he's the truth. You know, that's what they're saying down there. So, maybe they beat Carolina. That wouldn't shock me at all.
It wouldn't shock you at all. Is that what you just
said? That's right. It wouldn't shock me at all. And and we got to be careful. It rhymes with Todd Bowles' favorite words. So we got to, you know, be careful with shuck.
That is fair enough. All right, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us as always. Anything coming up for you other than your normal pick six stuff?
I did a little video today on the MVP race, and one of the interesting things about it was just the idea. A couple things. Matthew Stafford is if he wins the MVP, he's going to be on a real short list, and he's the favorite right now. Short list of Super Bowl winning quarterbacks who've been an MVP, like they all go to the Hall of Fame. So that's kind of an interesting thing of what's at stake with him. Certainly, if he were to win a second Super Bowl, yeah, that would be huge for him. But the other part of this is he the last completely immobile guy who could win the MVP? Brady's really the last one who didn't have any scramble yards hardly at all. Right now, I believe Stafford has 5 rushes, 2 of them are sneaks for no yards, and the others gained like 11 yards. You know, he has 3 scrambles, and I think Drake May has 49, you know? So it's a dying breed of player. Rivers is now reviving this breed of player, but yeah. We could be watching the last of the MVP guys who can't beat you with their legs.
Yes, Zombie Rivers. Yeah. We'll see how it comes. Mike, have a great weekend, man. It was so fun to talk and
thank you.
Have a great weekend. Take care. All right, that was Mike Sando of The Athletic, and always fun to catch up with Mike each Friday. If you haven't already given the show a like and click subscribe, now's a great time. I got to tell you guys something. I can't believe you all. It's wild. We are at, I'm going to refresh right now. We are at 29,787 subs on YouTube. We are 213 subscribers away from 30,000. And when we get there, I told you I'm going to buy tickets to give away to someone. And for the next game, as soon as it happens, the next game. So that could potentially be for this Colts game, but it's looking more likely that could be for the Rams game. So if we get there in time, another couple hundred people, I'll get tickets for the Rams game and give them away to some lucky person. So let's get that to 30,000 subs. Would greatly appreciate it. And also, you know, if you want to go on your own, you don't need to wait for getting free tickets, because I've taken advantage. I wish I could take advantage more often of the SeatGeek deal, but if you haven't already, make sure you do. It's gets tickets to anything you love and get a special deal, code HawkBlogger10. Also, if you haven't already, there's another great deal. If you want to go over to simplyseattle.com, get this hat I'm wearing or one of another great set of Seattle sports gear. From now until December 24th, if you use code HawkBlogger15, not only will you get 15% off, but you will also get a chance to have 5% of whatever you have bought will automatically be donated to the Fred Hutch Center's Patient and Family Assistance Fund, which provides vital help with transportation and temporary lodging for patients fighting for their lives. So make sure you take advantage. Use code HawkBlogger15 for 15% off. Also, if you buy one of their Simply Good hoodies, they're $25. $5 additionally will go to the Fred Hutch Cancer Center's Patient and Family Assistance Fund. So get a great deal for yourself or someone else and do good for others. A great way to do it. Go to jkboots.com/HawkBlogger. Use that URL to get your own special promo code, which will get you the best deal on the best boots you will own. I love my JK boots, and it's wet enough. This is a time for this boot season for sure. So grab jkboots.com/HawkBlogger, get a great deal, and get boots that you will always be happy that you have. And of course, go to Sleeper, download the Sleeper app, get $20 without even making a deposit. Plus, use promo code Hawks and you'll get up to $100 match on your first deposit. Terms and conditions apply. See Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational in over 25 states. Check out Sleeper today. All right. So let's talk about the implications of this game last night, because I don't know if everybody cares or followed along, but I was going through and looking at it myself. And essentially what has to happen for the Bucks to win this division is like the schedule for the Bucks is after this week. They've got at the Panthers. Then they are at the Dolphins, which, by the way, is not an easy game at this point. And then they are home against the Panthers, I believe, on the final game of the season. Looking for it. Where'd it go? Yes, they're home against. So two against the Panthers, one against the Dolphins. They need to win both of the games against the Panthers to really have a shot. That's assuming that they beat the Dolphins. And the reason is they would lose a tiebreaker to Carolina. Carolina's closing stretch is this week. Carolina plays at New Orleans, which, as Mike said, they've already lost to New Orleans. It's no guarantee, but that's where they play. Then they, after that, Carolina hosts the Bucks, which, by the way, is good news, because that's going to mean the Seahawks will face a Panthers team that will have faced a divisional foe The Seahawks will be on a extended kind of mini bye because they won't play until Sundays, but that's just whatever. Anyway, so they'll play the Bucks. Then the Panthers play, where is it? I'm looking in this confusing UI. Okay, then they play the Seahawks, of course. And then they, as I said, they finish by traveling to Tampa Bay. So they don't have an easy closing stretch either. But even if they lose to the Seahawks, if they, let's say this week, let's say that they beat the Saints, which I think is the odds-on favorite thing to do. So if they beat the Saints, that's an NFC game. And then if they win just one of the game against the Bucks, they're going to win that division. So if that's the case, the reason I'm spending all this time talking about the Bucks and the Panthers is there's really two most likely outcomes for the Seahawks and the Rams. One of them is probably going to be the number one seed. One of them is probably going to be the number five seed. And whoever is the number five seed will be traveling in the first week of the playoffs to play the fourth seed. The fourth seed is the worst divisional record. And as of now, it is much more likely that that's going to be the NFC South. And so it's either going to be Carolina or Tampa Bay. And at this point, I don't know who you'd rather face. Tampa Bay, I think, is significantly more talented than the Panthers. Panthers have a really good offensive line, good run game. Derek Brown is a handful on defense. J.C. Horn, like they're not bad, obviously, either. But I think you're gonna have potentially one or the other. And then there's this outlier situation, which probably, that's why I'm calling it an outlier, probably will not happen. But you've got a situation where the Eagles could fall to that fourth seed. What would have to happen there is they play the Commanders twice. Jaden Daniels, Dan Quinn, can that team get one of those kind of Falcons type wins where they just rise up and they're like for pride and for making a point? The Eagles just haven't been that good. Can they get one of the two against the Eagles? Maybe the Raiders beat them, but I don't think that's likely. But if they lose one of the two games against the Commanders, or if you want to think it simply, if they lose any of the games against the Commanders or the Raiders, that's three games. And then if Carolina beats the Saints and wins three of their final four is the easiest way to think about it. If the Eagles drop one and the Panthers win three of their final four, then the Panthers would have the tiebreaker and Philadelphia, the Eagles would end up being the host for either the Seahawks or the Rams. So, you know, I'm kind of curious, who folks would rather see. In fact, I'm curious enough. I'll put a poll here in chat up to you. And I'm really curious, who would you, obviously you want the number one seed in the bye. So who would you rather face in the first round if you had to? And we'll get the choices, the Bucks, the Panthers, and the Eagles. And I'm curious, okay, poll started. I'm curious where people vote on this one. I honestly could make a case for any of the three. The Bucks are playing the worst ball right now. The Panthers are probably the least talented. The Eagles might be the one with the least amount of home field advantage, given the fact that their fans are just out with pitchforks already. And if that team, if you got started quickly, that team would be booed, it would be, I don't know. So I am curious where people are. And so far it's a kind of a close race. We've got about 50 votes in, and most people by slim margin are preferring the Bucks, 44% to 42% for the Panthers. The Eagles are down 13. So people feel like they'd much rather face the Bucks or the Panthers. I mean, the Eagles, they haven't beat the Seahawks for a minute. And I think the Seahawks match up really well with the Eagles, to be honest. I really do. Seahawks stopped the run game. They've got really confusing coverages and great secondary players. I think Jalen Hurts would struggle. The only thing I'd say is Jalen Hurts can run, and that could be a problem. But I think generally the Seahawks match up pretty well against that team. Vic Fangio is a challenging guy to go against always, and probably he's the best defensive mind of that group. But I don't think they should be down there at 15%, such a distant third. I think it's pretty even in my mind. But yeah, it's now the Bucs are the team that most people would rather face. And I don't know. I'm struggling. I can't really say for sure because the Bucs are getting healthier. Mike Evans, they've got Jalen McMillan back. And, you know, they've got Chris Godwin and Igbuka. So I can't help. And they got Bucky Irving. Like, I can't help but think that they're going to find their feet and be playing better. But right now they are just trash. It's fascinating. And I was also looking at who has the hardest closing schedule, at least by DVOA. And you know what? It's should not come as a shock. The Seahawks have the second hardest closing schedule of any team in the NFL. So no one can say if the Seahawks win out, no one can say that the Seahawks didn't finish with a tough slate or beat anyone that mattered. The Rams have the third hardest. So Seahawks second hardest, Rams third hardest, or most difficult, if you'd like it. The Colts, the Seahawks play this week, have the most difficult closing stretch. Number one hardest schedule going forward. And then the 49ers, who also have an outside shot to win the division, they have the seventh hardest closing stretch. They've got the Bears. They've got the Seahawks. So it's going to be a fun ride, I think, the rest of the way. And I am really curious how the defense is able to affect and handle what Phillip Rivers does. There's a very likely scenario where they make him look foolish and everyone's like, you know what? Of course this was going to happen. No one's surprised. There's another scenario where Phillip Rivers is much more competent than people expect, and that the defense is getting really frustrated because he's managing to do things that they're not accustomed to, because there's not many, as Mike Sando said, there's not many quarterbacks that were able to decipher things the way those old quarterbacks were. And I hear what he says and everyone else says about how much defenses have changed and disguises have changed. Phillip Rivers hasn't been out of football. He's been out of the NFL. He's been coaching and he's been running Shane Steichen's offense. He clearly has an idea, not obviously at a high school level that they're running NFL defenses, but he has an idea of how the system is supposed to work. And I would assume that would be with a knowledge of what defenses are doing nowadays. But it's going to be fascinating. I'm curious. There is one super chat. I'll put this. And Jay Malfair says, do the Eagles have Jalen Carter? Well, as of right now, they do not. If they have him for the playoffs, is that like a yes or a no for you? Because I got to say, Jalen Carter has not been a difference maker this year. Like, he's not been the same dude that he's been in the past. That's not the player that gives me pause. I will say that, you know, the Eagles are, as a former Super Bowl team, it's generally hard to knock out the champ. So I will give you that. But no, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. I certainly would take where the Seahawks are over where some of these other folks are. As far as injury news, I should share that if you guys haven't already seen what's going on. Jalen Sundell practiced fully yesterday. He went from limited on Wednesday to full on Thursday. The Seahawks also let Cam Akers and Shaquille Griffin. Sorry, lots of things going through my head. Cam Akers and Shaquille Griffin are off the roster. They can be claimed by another team. They are vested vets, so that might have a little bit of impact there. But that clears two roster spots. It sure looks like Jalen Sundell is going to be one of them. Riley Mills, the defensive tackle, was a full go again as well. Maybe he's going to be activated. Eric Saubert was limited for a second straight day, the tight end. So I don't know. Like, the assumption was maybe he'd be back. Obviously, with Elijah Arroyo out, you'd like to have Eric Saubert back. Question mark about whether he'll be there. For the Colts, their right tackle, Braden Smith, did not practice again. So they might be playing a rookie there at right tackle. I still feel like we heard from Clint Kubiak yesterday that he feels like they've got two starting centers. I think that's a tell right there. The fact that he feels like they've got two starting centers means they're going to decide which one is the starting center in my mind, not whether or not he's going to take over at right guard. I think we've got our answer. I think he's going to stay at center. I think he's going to take back over. And I think Olu is going to be the backup. That is my expectation as of now, but we'll find out soon enough what the actual answer will be. And then if Riley Mills gets added to the roster, that's a story. That'll be really interesting. And I'll be curious about what that will mean for Mike Morris, what that will mean for, you know, any of the guys on the line. Is he going to get like part of the active roster? Like, is he going to get on the field? I wonder about this. And if they do this, it's a little bit of a commentary on probably a guy like Mike Morris, but it also would be a commentary on how much they believe and are excited about Riley Mills. Because the logical thing is not to ask a guy that's coming off a late ACL injury late last year, like a year ago, and had no training camp, hasn't played a snap in the NFL. The easy thing is just to redshirt the dude. But if they add him to the roster, that means that they think he is capable of helping them this year. And I'll be very curious, since I never got to see him practice, neither did they until just recently. I can't really comment on what to expect there, other than this guy has been just obsessed with everything related to football. He's kind of like Russell Wilson in the way that he would go through and mimic, like kind of take ghost reps of things during practice, even though he wasn't practicing. And he's super eager. So it'd be really fun to see. And, you know, I haven't been able to interview the guy yet because you don't talk to injured players, but I would love to get to know him a little bit more because he seems like a great guy and would be a great addition to that locker room as well. So yeah, a lot of interesting things going on there. Let me check to see. I think there might have been a Venmo super chat. I don't want to miss it. So let me pull up Venmo real quick and double check. And I'll let you guys know. If you ever want to give me a Venmo super chat, it's always appreciated because unlike YouTube super chats, which I love as well, 100% of the proceeds from a Venmo super chat go to me, where 30% go to Google through YouTube. So it's just Brian-Nemhauser over there on Venmo. And we've got one from Forrest Anderson. Says, does the Kubiak scheme center call pass and run protection similarly to the Shanahan scheme? Does the center have control, but Sam Darnold can adjust pass pro calls? I'm really curious about this and whether or not it weighs in on Olu versus Sundell being our center in the next coming weeks. It's a great question, Forrest. And I actually have that on my list of questions, and I almost asked it the past couple of weeks. Mike McDonald said that they have their own unique way of setting protections. And part of me wonders if I'm going to get much of an answer, if they want to kind of keep that under wraps. I'm still probably going to ask it at some point because I am curious. I know that Clint Kubiak has been very clear about how important it is for his center to be smart. Like that center really needs to know what he's doing. And that implication is the center's definitely involved with the line calls and reading what's going on. But I think Sam might have some say. The other thing I've heard that kind of gave you a clue is Mike McDonald said, I think this might have been after the Falcons game, or maybe it was after the Vikings game during that week leading up to the Falcons game. Anyway, said something along the lines of, you know, we didn't have the protections right, or we didn't do a good job protecting. That's not on Sam. And it wasn't just about blocking. It was about the way protections were set. And that made me think, the way that he said it, that Sam does not have as much responsibility for setting protections. But I honestly don't know the answer. I am curious about it. It's on my mind, but I don't have the answer for you. Folks, I think that will do it for this edition of Hawkblogger Mornings. Head over to patreon.com/hawkblogger. Go ahead and grab a subscription, join the community. We got a lot of folks in the Discord server talking about Seahawks and all sorts of other stuff all the time. So hang out there with us, and also get you ad-free audio and a bunch of other great goodies, including locker room audio when I've got it. patreon.com/hawkblogger. So if you want to give it as a gift, by the way, patreon.com/hawkblogger/gift. Just add /gift to the end. You can give the gift of the Hawkblogger community to someone you love, or to yourself, but really to someone you love. And it's a unique gift. It's quick. It's easy. And I think they'll really thank you for it. All right, folks, that'll do it. Take care. I'm Brian Emhauser. This has been your Friday edition of Hawkblogger.